whole series on bibliology and visited a number of different things, like where we got the English language and such as that. And now we'd like to do a little short study on how we got our Bible. And so I thought this would be a good time to take that study up. And so we'll start by talking about the text of the Old and New Testaments. Where did they come from? How did they get into the form that we see them in our printed Bibles today? Well, to go back to the ancient Hebrew texts, and we'll start with the Old Testament, the oldest that we have extant, and it might be surprising to most of us, actually only dates back to 900 AD, and it's called the Masoretic text. Now, there's a reason for that, and the reason is because the Jews were so zealous of the scriptures that when they made copies, they destroyed the old ones. And so that's why you don't find old copies and fragments of the Hebrew Old Testament extant today.
Although the Dead Sea Scrolls are considerably older than that.
Yes, and we'll get to those too. Absolutely. We will talk about the Dead Sea Scrolls. But that was a different class of documents, and so we're taking the Masoretic text first. Now, these Masoretes, as they were called, they lived in Tiberias and in Babylon, and about 900 AD, they put this text together, and they claimed that they had done it from the very best manuscripts that they had available. And because now there's so much distance between 900 AD and today, there's no Masoretes around to ask the question, well, where did you get your source documents? But they claimed that they were the best manuscripts that they had available to them, and they did copy it with extraordinary care. They were very zealous of the Word of God, but rather than to destroy the copies, they then began to keep and to use those copies. And they were also the first that brought in vowel points. As we know, Hebrew is a consonant language. And so the reader, when he reads the Hebrew text, he inserts the vowels himself. And so that makes it difficult to understand the pronunciation of some of the words, because the Jews that are alive today have no idea how to add the vowels in. And that's the reason why sometimes you'll hear the name of God pronounced Yahweh instead of Jehovah. And it's from the Tetragrammaton, as it's called, the four Hebrew consonants in the name of God. And if you insert one set of vowel points, you get Yahweh. And if you insert another set of vowel points, then you get Jehovah. And so that's why you see those two different spellings name for the name of God. And so it was the Masoretes that actually invented the vowel pointing system, and they worked out a system of accents that would help the Hebrew readers to be able to retain the pronunciation of some of the words, because they're very ancient Hebrew words. They go all the way back to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and that's been a very long time, and they spoke a different dialect of Hebrew, if you will, than what was current in the Masoretes' age. And so they contributed a lot to the transmission and presentation of the Old Testament. And when we get to versions here, now a version is a translation into another language of the original Greek and Hebrew. And so they presented a great deal of evidence to back up what we sometimes call the King James Version. And we'll talk about that later. The next one that we want to talk about in precedence is the Sumerian Pentateuch. Now, that might be kind of surprising, because as the Samaritans were heretics so far as the Jews were concerned, they actually kept their old copies of the Pentateuch. They didn't follow the customs that they had down in Judea, where they would destroy the old scrolls. When they were worn out in the synagogues, they would throw them away. Actually, they didn't throw them away. They very carefully burned them to not leave any evidence. And they began to use the new scrolls. And we know that they were extraordinarily careful in their copying of the Old Testament scriptures. So we have the Samaritan Pentateuch, and they kept those copies. And you can still get copies of the Samaritan Pentateuch today. And a lot of people are very interested in studying it because there are some readings in there that are considerably different than the Masoretic text. And so it's an interesting thing, if you're into studying the original languages, to find out different families of Old Testament manuscripts. So it's important. The next we want to talk about is called the Malabar manuscripts. And those were discovered in the early 1800s, and they were kept by the Jews at Malabar, and it had some 37 skins on which were written the Old Testament scriptures. And they had kept those from antiquity. They were a community of the Jews, kind of like the Qumran, which we'll get to in a moment, that produced the Dead Sea Scrolls. They copied these things from early manuscripts, and then they were very careful to preserve them. And so when we compare the Malabar manuscript to the Masoretic text or the Dead Sea Scrolls, we find out that there's very slight differences between the Malabar manuscript and, let's say, the Masoretic text or the Samaritan Pentateuch. And so what this adds up to, since it's over a large division of time, a long division of time, and different people groups doing it, that tells you that the scriptures were supernaturally protected by God. And the variations that were found between the Malabar manuscripts and the earlier texts were small and unimportant. They wouldn't affect any major doctrine of the Bible at all. And then lastly, as Joshua brought up, there's the Dead Sea Scrolls. And these Dead Sea Scrolls were put together by a sect called the Essenes. They were a super legalistic Jewish sect. And what they did was make copies of the Old Testament manuscripts, and they'd seal them up in jars for antiquity, and they put them in these caves where they were discovered. It's close to Jericho. And so they were miraculously preserved in very good condition when they were discovered. And so what this does, it allows us to go back almost 1,000 years. So the Dead Sea Scrolls are extremely important. My notes here say that one of the important books in the Dead Sea Scrolls is Isaiah, and that scroll was dated approximately 100 B.C. when it was written, and it agrees with the texts that we find that are King James and even the Alexandrian manuscripts, which we'll speak of in due turn. So one of the things we find out is that the Dead Sea Scrolls further corroborate the evidence that the Bible was supernaturally preserved. So one of the things that it allowed people to do is this idea of settling the so-called Deutero-Isaiah theory. Now, the modernists, which come out of the German schools of rationalism, had decided that the Bible needed to be debunked. And one of the ways that they were going to debunk the Bible is take all the supernatural content out of it, because that clearly could never happen. It couldn't stand the test of human intelligence. And so that's what they did. And since Isaiah had near-term and long-term prophecies in his book, they tried to say that the long-term prophecies were actually written by a different Isaiah who was alive at the time that they were fulfilled, and not the original Isaiah. And so the idea was is to get rid of the supernatural content, like Isaiah could not foretell the future accurately because that would be supernatural. Well, to get rid of that, they just said, well, there were two Isaiahs. And sometimes they would even say, well, there were three or more Isaiahs, all to the same end, to remove the idea that the Bible is a supernatural book. Well, the discovery of the Dead Sea Scrolls laid that to rest because there's scant any difference between the book of Isaiah in the Dead Sea Scrolls, which were much, much later, and the original Masoretic text, the Samaritan Pentateuch, the Malabar manuscripts that we've just talked about. They're amazingly similar. Now, they're not exactly the same, but they're amazingly similar, and most of the variations, and we're going to talk about variations when we get to New Testament texts, but most of the variations are small, copyist errors that are very easily discerned, and so it's not a real problem with accepting those works as authentic. So, the Dead Sea Scrolls are extremely important. They were found in 1947, by the way. And the discovery of the Dead Sea Scrolls really revolutionized the idea of original language studies and also what we now call lower criticism. Lower criticism is linguists comparing different copies of the Bible, the original tongues, one with another, and trying to produce a consistent text consistent with all of the copies, with the obvious errors removed. And that also is going to go on in the New Testament texts as well. But that's what they were up to. And so, by the time that the Dead Sea Scrolls were discovered, there was a great inducement to let's press this study further. Let's make this a science all by itself. And so the science of lower criticism, or comparing original language manuscripts one with another to determine where the original came from, and that all of the manuscripts that have been found were descended from an original, that came into vogue, and it's been pursued since the 1950s until today. It's an exacting science. Yes, that's true. But the Septuagint isn't really an original language. It's a translation of the Old Testament scriptures into Greek. So that has to be discussed under some of the New Testament stuff here, because it's a version. The Septuagint is a version, I should say. So that brings us then, well, what about the New Testament? What do we know about the source documents of the New Testament? Because if you can't verify the source documents, then you can't really verify a version. The King James is a version, and a version is a translation from the original language into another language, in this case, the English language. So if the translators did not have reliable source documents, they couldn't produce a reliable translation. So that's very important. So when we come to the New Testament now, and by the way, there isn't a whole lot of argument over the Old Testament texts and the veracity of the Old Testament text. Most of the attacks by the modernists are all on the New Testament, and that shouldn't surprise us at all. Satan even has a limited amount of time. And so rather than mess around with the Old Testament texts, well, he's decided he's going to try to cast aspersions of doubt on the New Testament. And I think we can see why he would do that. So, source documents then for the New Testament, and there are so many of them. There are over 5,000, ranging from scraps and fragments all the way to complete copies of the New Testament extant today, because the Christians didn't destroy the copies of the scriptures like the Jews did. And so there's all kinds of them floating around, probably many which have still to be discovered. But
although it is worth pointing out that most of those copies are later than 1000 AD.
Oh, yes, of course.
The vast majority of them are.
Yes, that's true. But if you want to look at source documents that way, well, was there ever a blind poet named Homer? The oldest source documents that we have for Homer only go back 800 years. And so what Joshua says is true with all of these different sorts of documents, but we also have some that go back almost to the apostolic times. So some of these fragments are that old, although most are not. It's true. So, the New Testament, there's a document called the Chester Beatty Papyri, and it goes back to 300 AD, and it was the oldest one that had been discovered up to that point. And so it was kind of the reigning source document if you were looking for something that was really old. Dates back to 300 AD. Another source document is the Sinaiticus. And the reason that it's called the Sinaiticus is because it was found in a monastery at the foot of Mount Sinai, and some monks had thought that it wasn't worth anything, and a couple of explorers that were interested in original languages called Westcott and Hort, they were over there poking around trying to find old manuscripts of the scriptures, and they noticed that in the monk's trash bin was this almost complete copy of the New Testament. And since it was found at Sinai, well, they gave it the name Sinaiticus, because that sounds scholarly. We've got to have scholarly names here. Another one is called the Vaticanus. And it's called the Vaticanus because it was discovered and kept by the Vatican and kept in the Vatican. And we'll discover later that the Roman Catholic Bible that they used up until recent times, the Reims-Douay translation, was actually made from the Vaticanus, as we would expect it to be. Then there's the Alexandrius. This was discovered in Alexandria, Egypt, and it's used as a source document. We'll probably talk about that more. And then there's the Washingtonius, and I have no idea how they got Washington's name on this, but it's a very old source document. I don't know how it got that name. Then, and I'm giving you preliminary materials now that we'll go back and look at a lot closer in its parts. So, ancient translations or versions, the Old Testament. First of all, we have the Septuagint, has already been mentioned, and it was written, as close as anyone can tell, between 150 and 250 BC. So, it's pretty old. It was written by the 70 of Alexandria, which is why it's called the Septuagint. Septuagint means 70, or Septus means 70. And so, supposedly, the Jews had gotten together 70 scholars. In fact, the King James translators are going to kind of copy this. And these 70 people worked together, and they cross-checked each other's work. They used the best source documents that each of them had available. And then they compared them all together, which is why a lot of the Bible scholars think that the version that they produced, the Septuagint, is the most accurate copy of the Old Testament, because it was a result of study of the Jews themselves. So what is it? Well, it's a translation, since it's a version, from the Old Testament Hebrew text to Koine Greek. Not Attic Greek, but Street Greek, just like we're going to find in the King James and the manuscripts that it's translated from. So the Jews of Alexandria and early Christians, they knew of the Septuagint and used it widely. And because it so faithfully corroborates the Old Testament text we just got done talking about, it's been attacked by modernist scholars left and right, so much so that they claim it didn't even exist, but it very clearly does. We have copies of it, lots of copies of it. And so it's relentlessly attacked, and it's attacked because it shows the veracity of the Old Testament text. It's right there before us, and it's something that was done on scholarship rather than just collecting a bunch of ancient texts and collating them. Okay. What's next? The Syriac version. This is the oldest translation of the Bible. It's called the Peshitta, and Peshitta simply means simple. It was the simple translation of its day. It was designed to be read by ordinary people that weren't steeped in scholarship. And so it was written at the end of the first century in Mesopotamia. It's still used today, and you can get a copy of it today if you can find one at your local bookstore. Probably you'd have to go to online sources. I have one at the house. And so it's an interesting version. And it was written in Aramaic. Now, it's been translated from Aramaic into English, of course, but the original translation was written in Aramaic because that was the spoken language that was used in Palestine. That's what the Lord used. He used Aramaic, and the disciples all used Aramaic, and all of the people at that time in Judea were using Aramaic. And only some of the priests and scribes had any real working knowledge of ancient Hebrew. It wasn't commonly spoken anymore. It's like people running around speaking Greek today. You don't find it very often in this country. Now, it's more common in Greece, I've been told. Nonetheless, it contains the entire Old Testament and parts of the New Testament. It does not have 2nd and 3rd John, Peter, Jude, and Revelation. That's not in there, because apparently they didn't have the source texts for those. But it does take us back a very long way in the history of translations. Let's continue on a little bit further then and talk about some of the subdivisions of these versions or translations. And the first one we probably should mention, since it's one of the earliest, is called the Latin Vulgate. And it's called the Latin Vulgate because it was written in the vulgar tongue. Vulgar simply means common. We use the word a little bit different today, but it simply means the common speech as used by the people in those days. And it came about because as time starts to go by, the Bishop of Rome becomes more and more important in the church. It's going to lead to the Bishop of Rome declaring himself Pope. He hasn't done it yet, but he carries an enormous amount of weight because the church at Rome was the largest Christian gathering in all the world at that time. And so, of course, it's going to carry that degree of influence. And so the Bishop of Rome decided, we can't just have all these ancient manuscripts laying around that nobody can read anymore. We need something written in the Latin language that the common person can understand. And so he commissioned this translation to be made, and it was done by Jerome, his Latin Vulgate, and it was done in about 384 A.D., up to about 404 A.D. So it goes back there quite a ways. The next one that we probably need to talk about is much more recent than that. And you'll see why some people say, well, the Latin Vulgate ought to be the thing that we put the most credence in because it's the oldest. Not necessarily, as we'll see. The next that we want to talk about, in 1382, a guy named Wycliffe decided that the English-speaking people needed a translation that they could read in their own language. Now, in times before, Latin was commonly spoken in the British Isles, but gradually as English began to supplant the old Germanic tongues as we studied when we studied ancient languages some time back, it kind of fell into disuse, and most people by this time are not familiar with Latin anymore. If they're going to speak a foreign language, it's almost certainly to be French. And English is rapidly supplanting French in the British Isles. And so it was decided that they needed a translation, and the Roman Catholics, who held sway politically in the British Isles at that time, did not want a modern translation to be brought forth. They wanted the Roman Catholic Bible to be used in the churches of England. But most of the people in that time realized that the Latin Vulgate has some serious problems, and it dates back to its source documents, which we'll talk about a little bit later. But along comes John Wycliffe anyway, and he makes this translation, and the fatal flaw with his translation is he translated the Latin Vulgate into English with all of its inherent problems, so it didn't really last very long. Most people started figuring out, well, if we're going to read the Wycliffe translation, we might as well read the Latin Vulgate because it's Wycliffe's translation of that. And since they didn't trust it to begin with, since Protestantism was making inroads into the British Isles at this time, there was a distrust of that. That brings us later on to Tyndale's translation. I'm sure you've heard of these guys before. There's a Christian group today called the Wycliffe Bible Translators that are still translating the scriptures into all the obscure languages of the earth, and they took Wycliffe's name. Good choice, by the way. The big difference with Tyndale's translation now is because people were suspicious of the Latin Vulgate and Tyndale's translation of the Latin Vulgate into English, there was a demand for something that went back to better source documents than what was available to Jerome when he translated the Latin Vulgate, because he used the Vaticanus, which is a family of manuscripts we'll talk about later that the NIV, the ASV, and some others are translated from even today, and we'll see that there are some problems with those. So Tyndale's translation was a direct translation now. This is something new from Hebrew and Greek. And for a source document for the Greek, he used Erasmus's Textus Receptus, and we'll talk about that later, because there is still a huge controversy over the King James Bible and the text that it was translated from as being too old-fangled. Yes. So, at that same time, by the way, as a side note, when Tyndale was busy translating the original Hebrew and Greek into English for use in the British Isles, this is the same time that Luther was busy in Germany translating the Latin Vulgate into German. And you know what kind of trouble he got into for doing that. He was not found with favor by the Pope. So Tyndale finished his translation in Germany because it was too dangerous to do it in England. The Protestants were heavily censured in the British Isles. So Tyndale actually did his work in Germany, where there was a large contingent of Moravians and people like that, people from which the Baptists were descended from. And they gave him quarter so that he could carry on his work without being burned at the stake. And so, oh, by the way, it didn't work. He finished his New Testament in 1525, and he finished the Pentateuch in 1530. So now it's translated into English, but in 1536, he was burned at the stake for his pains. And his famous statement, I think most of you have heard, as he was dying at the stake, cried out, "Lord, open the King of England's eyes." The next that we probably want to talk about here now is the Cloverdale Bible. And it was Miles Cloverdale now that gave England its first complete Bible from Genesis to Revelation. These translations that we've talked about that came before were missing parts. Well, Cloverdale has got the whole thing put together. And, of course, he had to work on it in Germany as well because of the persecution in England. And it was the first complete Bible, Genesis to Revelation, that had been printed in the English tongue. He also was responsible for the Geneva Bible and the Great Bible, which we're going to talk about in a moment. So when he did this translation that we're talking about now, the Cloverdale Bible, he's going to come back with a new and improved. And by the way, when we get to the Geneva Bible, we're going to find out it was the Great Bible of the Reformation. Okay.
By the way, that Codex Washingtoniana.
Yes.
It's named after its location. It's kept in the Smithsonian in Washington, D.C.
Okay.
That's why it's called that. So.
Good. Thanks for looking that up, because I really didn't know. But I figured if Washington had anything to do with it, I'm not sure I'm going to trust it. Okay, the Matthew's Bible. This guy was done, this translation, I should say, was done by John Rogers, but he called himself Matthew's to disguise himself, so he wouldn't end up at the same stake that Tyndale was tied to. See, these people were being persecuted. Because England now is on the cusp of Henry VIII coming to the throne and kicking the Roman Catholics out of England because of all the persecution that they had done to these people that we're talking about, burning them at the stake. Well, he disguised his name because he was a friend of Tyndale. And so just being tainted with the name of Tyndale could get you burned at the stake. So I think you can start to see that this idea of producing an English Bible was fraught with dangers. Satan fought it hammer and tong. So 65% of Matthew's Bible, or Roger's Bible, more properly, it was done by Tyndale himself. Matthew's just copied it. And, interesting, he didn't escape the stake either. He turns out to be the first martyr that Queen Mary, or Bloody Mary as she was known, came to the throne in England and was attempting now once again to exterminate the Reformation in England. So he has the distinction of being her first kill. After that, we have what's called the Great Bible. And this, again, is another work of Cloverdale that we talked about a moment ago. And it doesn't have that much claim to fame other than it clears up some of the controversial things that were found in translations that the Latin Vulgate was made from. But it was the blueprint for the Geneva Bible. Now, this is the one that we really want to pay attention to, because this was the Bible that was in use by the Puritans that founded this country, and also by the ones that finally brought about Reformation in the British Isles. When Bloody Mary is removed, the Geneva Bible is now copied and becomes commonplace in churches in England. So it was very important to the English-speaking people. Now, Geneva was an interesting place. It's not only the place where John Calvin held court, but it was a place where Englishmen could flee to get away from Bloody Mary and her persecutions. The Swiss cantons were a relatively safe place. And it was also safe, of course, for others like Calvin. Now, the English translation was divided into verses first. The first place that you see chapter and verse divisions in the English translation of the Bible, you find in the Geneva Bible. So that was a revolutionary thing. And any words that the translators had inserted were put in italics. And so people could look at that and see what the translators had done. And it also had an orderly layout by division of chapters and verses so that people could quickly reference scriptures. Very useful for that. The Old Testament was carefully compared with the Hebrew text, and the New Testament was revised with Beza, Theodore Beza, and we'll talk about him when we talk about the King James and the Textus Receptus. But the Geneva Bible was revised using his Latin version. He did produce a Latin version. And the Geneva Bible was the Bible that shaped the minds of the Puritans of England. And by the way, I'm not in any way defending the Puritans. They were as vile a persecutors of true Christianity as the Catholics were. Coming down now, past the Geneva Bible, we have the Bishop's Bible. So, the Bishop's Bible was just simply a version that was based on Greek scholarship, and there was an order made in England in 1571 that every bishop and archbishop should have this Bible because it was determined that it was a much better translation, and since the bishops were supposed to be teaching the people, they wanted to teach, have it taught from the best source materials. And so it was produced by the English government for use in the churches. It became the first sort of an idea of an authorized version. Now, by authorized, it doesn't mean that God authorized it. It means that the government of England authorized it for use in the churches, because I'm sure you realize that it was very common in Europe to have a state church. That's one of the reasons that we have the First Amendment in our Constitution, to stop that very sort of thing from happening. So, let's see, what else do we want to say? Nothing on that Bishop's Bible anymore. Let's go to the Reims Douay version, since Bloody Mary needed a Bible too. And so the Reims Douay version is a Roman Catholic English translation. Now, it's not used today, but it was used up until recent times. The Catholics have got a different version that they're using these days, and I can't remember what it is off the top of my head, and it's not in my notes. So, therefore, I don't know. But the thing about the Reims Douay is it was not translated from the original language. It was a translation from the Latin Vulgate. So it's not a translation from Greek and Hebrew into English. It's a translation of a translation, if that makes sense. And what else can we say about that? Well, a guy named Gregory Martin was responsible for the translation, and the Roman Catholics used it until recent times. Then we come down to the great one, the one that we'll probably spend the most time on, which is the King James Version, or Authorized Version. So we first got the idea of an authorized version with the Bishop's Bible, because it was commissioned by government order. Well, the King James is commissioned by government order too, but this time it's King James that decides that we need a universal English translation that all of the Anglican churches use, so that everybody in the whole Anglican denomination is on the same sheet of music. Because before that, most of the common people would use the Geneva Bible, and they would carry that to church with them, but they'd hear the pulpit message come at them from the Bishop's Bible, and because there were certain differences between the two, that created problems within the denomination. So to get rid of that problem, the government wanted to have a universal translation that would be accepted by everybody within the Church of England. And that would eliminate having these sorts of problems arise from differences in what they heard from the pulpit and what they were reading from the Bible that they were carrying. Well, most of them were too big to carry them around, but they had them at home. So the King James Bible has the Great Bible and the Bishop's Bible used in the church, while the common people use the Geneva. And the King James Version was translated to win the allegiance of all the groups within the church. Now, you can see that it's going to be a little bit dicey because while Bloody Mary was on the throne, all of the reformers were suppressed and burned at the stake, all that she could lay her hands on anyway. And so you've got a very turbulent religious system going on in England, and it needs to be fixed. And so King James now comes to the throne, reverses all of Bloody Mary's policies, and begins to encourage the Reformation within England once again. And so now he needs a consistent version which everyone is willing to accept to get rid of all the divisions within the Church of England. And so that's what he's up to. Now in the translation, they had 54 men, where you remember the Septuagint, they got 70 scholars together because Septus, 70. Okay, they have 47. And so, well, there were 54, but not all of them actually worked on the translation. 47 of them did. And the translators were using the Bishop's Bible, and they were split up into six groups. And these groups all worked separately and independently, even more so than the Septuagint. In the Septuagint, it's not documented that the 70 all worked independently and then compared their works. But it is documented that in the King James translation, these translators formed six separate groups. They independently did their translation work, and then they would periodically meet together and compare all their notes and attempt to hash out any differences that they found. So it was a pretty good approach. It's a peer-reviewed, if you will, translation of the Bible. So far, so good. It took 4 years of translating and then two more years of study over the finished translation and the revisions made before we ended up with the final product. And that was 1611, as we all know. And so there are people that just absolutely give reverence to the King James Bible because it's the authorized version. In other words, they're intimating that it's authorized by God and everything else isn't. That nothing could be further from the truth. It was authorized by King James only for use in the Anglican religion in England. But it became so popular after people started figuring out that it is a good translation, not as good as some of the later ones, like the American Standard and others, but it has a really good source document. And so to talk about that, we're going to have to talk about the source documents that the King James was translated from, and we'll have to talk about the Textus Receptus or Received Text. Now, it hasn't been very many years ago, probably 20 years ago, that within Baptist circles there was a huge controversy raging concerning the King James versus other translations. And it got so downright ugly that the King James proponents would say that those that wanted to use the American Standard or some translation from that series of manuscripts were just demon-possessed. And then the other side would say, well, you King James-only people, you have very poor scholarship, and there's been so many revisions to the King James Bible, who could figure out which one is right? And so it was a very bitter controversy, and so it's kind of important for us to know about that, because you'll run into people, especially from Baptists and some Bible church persuasions, that are still tilting at windmills. They're still fighting over this issue. So it's kind of important, I think, for us to at least have some basic knowledge of what that's all about, so we know what we think when we hear all of these different arguments going on. And with that, let's pray.